Welcome to our Bible study on the book of Isaiah, chapter 40, verse 21 through 31. As always, I am assuming that you have read the passage, that you have your Bible open before you, and that you understand our translations may not always agree. But most scholars agree that at chapter 40, we cross a significant boundary in the book of Isaiah. The Babylonian victory over Judah and Jerusalem, which had been talked about earlier, is coming to a close. At chapter 40, verse 2, we read that Jerusalem has received from the Lord's hand double for all her sins. But now we come to the good news of the end of the Babylonian exile. At chapter 40, verse 1, we read, "Comfort, comfort my people." Now Isaiah proclaims over and over that the Judeans who live in the foreign nation are about to be released and allowed to return home. His central proclamation rests on a strong theological foundation. His confidence in both the power and the gracious will of God, who is the only God. Now for a historical interlude. Historically, this is pretty much what had happened. First, the Assyrians had defeated Israel and the 10 northern tribes around 740 to 701 BC. Judah and the two southern tribes, Judah and Benjamin, were pretty much a vassal state. And then Babylon came along, defeated Assyria and Judah around 596 BC, put some of the citizens in exile. And then an ill-advised rebellion took place in Judah. And in 586, Babylon not only defeated them, but leveled Jerusalem and the temple, and took just about everyone into exile. But the Babylonian kingdom did not last long after the king of Nebuchadnezzar in 562. Persia rose to power. Cyrus was the king, and conquered the two powers that had divided the Near Eastern world at the fall of Assyria. First, he defeated the Median Empire in 550 BC, and then Babylon in 539. So now, the Persian Empire extended as far west as the western coast of Asia Minor. So why it is important? I bring this up because in Isaiah, we see a prophet who lifted the meaning of these events from the level of political history to the level of understanding world history as a drama of redemption. Isaiah proclaims that the Lord is about to redeem his people, that Babylon would fall, and as we read in chapter 41, verses 5 through 7, and in chapter 44, verse 28, and in verse 45, verse 1 and following, that Cyrus had been called and empowered by the Lord to carry out God's will in history, and was destined to play an important part in the return of Israel to Zion and in the restoration of Jerusalem. We have in chapters 40 through 66 a prophecy that is tempered with tears, mixed with a joy that heals scars, clearing a way for understanding the future in spite of the present. Few words have gone further in offering comfort when a sick world cries. Now to our passage. Our passage is actually a part of a larger section beginning back at verse 12, so chapter 40, verse 12 through 31. Earlier in chapter 40, from verses 1 through 11, Isaiah had announced the end of the exile and the return of God's people to their land. Isaiah uses graphic spatial images here from 12, and at verse 40, I'm sorry, at chapter 40, verse 15, and striking rhetorical figures to communicate unbounded confidence in the ruler of creation. His style is almost like a hymn, praising God by describing God, for example, in verses 22 and 23, as the one who is over all the world. The style and structure of our passage are dominated by mainly rhetorical questions, which both make assertions and assume answers that lay the foundation for the responses that follow. Mainly, these questions are addressed directly to the audience, who originally had been the dispirited Judean captives in Babylon. The you of verses 21, 25, 27, and 28. The first section of our passage, verses 21 through 24, the meaning of questions, verse 21, is not clear until the answer is given. For example, the question of verse 21, what is it that the audience has not known that they have or should have known from the beginning? That question is answered in verses 22 through 24, that the one who sits on above the circle of the earth, the one over all space, is also the one who brings down princes and rulers, the one who is indeed the ruler over historical events. Indeed, before the Lord, the rulers are like stubble before the wind. The second section, in verses 25 through 26, also begins with rhetorical questions. To whom then will you compare me? Or who is my equal? It means that the Lord is incomparable, without equal. But the question is answered, first with a command to look to the heavens, and then with another rhetorical question, who created these? Followed with an assertion of God's creation and control of the hosts of heaven. Given that these words are spoken in Babylon, brings a bit of an edge to these lines. In Babylon, the stars were identified with various gods. Are these gods comparable to the one true God? Obviously, the answer is no, for God created them and calls them out of their appointed places every night. Though they can hardly be counted, the Lord knows them by name. The third section, verses 27 through 31, begins with an actual question addressed to Israel's sense of the absence of God. Why do people say that God is unaware of their plight? For example, at verse 27, my way is hid from the Lord. Or again in verse 27, that God ignores their just cause, their right. But this is also a rhetorical question asserting that the people are mistaken. Its response begins with a repetition of the questions of verse 21. Have you not known? Have you not heard? Followed by assertions and promises. The assertions move from the cosmic to the personal. God is the everlasting God, the creator of the whole earth, who never tires and whose understanding is, as it says in verse 28, beyond human comprehension. As we read in verse 29, this is the God who gives power to the faint and strengthens the powerless. But then the promises draw the conclusion for the people of God, for those who now are saying that they have been abandoned by God in verse 31. Those who wait for the Lord shall renew their strength. They shall mount up with wings like eagles. They shall run and not be weary. They shall walk and not faint. To wait for the Lord is to have confidence or faith and the sense of committing ourselves to God in hopeful expectation. The passage as a whole amounts to an argument that the dispirited and despondent exiles have good reason to be hopeful. The God who calls them and us to freedom is the same God who created the earth, who calls out the stars, whose strength knows no limit, and who gives strength to the faint and the powerless. For a conclusion, I want us to look closer at verse 31. In Hebrew poetry, the triplets, that is a three-line sequence, like in verse 31, grow in emphasis from the first to the third. In other words, The last line is more important than the middle, and the middle is more important than the first, which seems to be totally counterintuitive for verse 31. It makes more sense to say, they shall walk and not faint, they shall run and not be weary, they shall mount up with wings like eagles. Certainly, flying like an eagle should be the pinnacle moment, not walking without falling down. But sometimes, no matter how much we want to soar like an eagle, all we can do is barely manage to put one foot in front of the other, over and over and over again. Maybe that is the pinnacle. Maybe the very best thing is simply to be able to walk in faith and with strength, knowing that God is walking with us. Thank you for listening. Take care and God bless.